my experience over and over working with people like Elizabeth is that the first or second or even third story you hear are the easy ones. And if you keep hearing stories, they get weirder and then they get weirder. They never finally make sense.
This is Jeffrey Kripal. He's a scholar of religion with a chair in philosophy and religious thought at Rice University. He collects stories like Elizabeth's. Telepathic dreams, near-death experiences, alien abductions. Stories that would seem to have a lot more in common with cable TV than church. But Kripal believes these are the deep roots of religion. Anomalous experiences that sound crazy and turn people's worlds upside down. Steve Paulson asked, like what?
I could tell you stories of a haunted necklace, of plants that die when their owners die, reading minds.
You're talking about what we would call paranormal experiences.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not usually what we think about as religion. We tend to sort of put that in an entirely different category.
Well, that's a mistake. You know, the word paranormal is a very new word. It was coined in 1903 by a French scientist. And it's a way, or it's an attempt to secularize and make natural experiences that had always before that had a religious framework. And these experiences happen every day to thousands of people. But we live in a culture that suppresses them in various explicit and implicit ways. And so people don't talk about them. Elizabeth waited 30 years to come out of her closet.
That is not my image of religion. I mean, that's usually talk about God or the Bible or sacred scriptures. That's not what you're talking about here.
No, I think things like God and scripture and tradition are later developments of these same sorts of experiences that then get remembered in a community and they develop into ideas. So, for example, if you had, say, 100 or 200 people like Elizabeth who had a similar kind of near-death experience, you would have stories floating around in the community about how the soul survives bodily death and we have these capacities to receive information from the future. And then you would develop beliefs like the soul, prophecy, divination, that sort of thing. And of course, that's exactly what you see in the history of religions. I'm interested in the sort of sources, the kind of experiential sources of religion.
You're talking about that, what people actually experience that then later turns into a codified sense of religion.
That's correct. I'm sort of interested in religion before it becomes religion. These anomalous events or extreme experiences that form the basis of various religious ideas like the existence of a soul. And so my position is that these beliefs are not crazy, superstitious things that silly people make up. These beliefs are the direct outcome of actual experiences.
Do we have to try to figure out whether these psychic experiences, whether someone talks about seeing a ghost or having a precognitive experience, whether those are literally true, or what do we do with those?
I think the first thing we do is we recognize that they happen. I think the conversation gets shut down by the debunkers who want to say they never happen or that they're always fraudulent, which clearly is not the case. It's simply false. What they do for us that's so productive is that they help us realize that what we consider impossible is simply a function of our present models of the natural world. And so they're productive, they're creative, they're intellectually stimulating, and that's why I find them so fascinating.
So how far back does this idea of religion go for you? Does this go all the way back to your childhood?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I grew up in Nebraska in a farming community. I wasn't particularly religious as a boy. I grew up Roman Catholic. But when I hit puberty, I became super, super pious and ended up in a monastic seminary wanting to be a monk.
How long did you last in the monastic seminary?
4 years. And at the end of the day, my monastic mentors thought, and I agreed with them, that I didn't actually have a religious vocation. I had an intellectual vocation, and that I needed to go to graduate school and not enter the monastery. So that's what I did.
You've also written about some of the cultural aspects of being in that seminary that didn't fit. I mean, you said that pretty much all the other guys in the seminary were gay and you weren't.
Right. It was definitely a gay community. And by that, I mean, most of the men, most of the young men were closeted gay men who had turned to the priesthood or the religious life as a way of positively and creatively sublimating that into some kind of spiritual life. And I wasn't gay. I was highly repressed, but I was ultimately straight, and I just didn't fit in.
Was that just kind of a weird quirk of this particular seminary that you were in, or does this say something deeper about the nature of religion?
Well, the argument I make in Secret Body is that this kind of male homoeroticism is orthodox in the history of Christianity, because God is always male. And if you are going to be in love with God or marry Jesus, to use the Catholic language, a male homoerotic orientation works very well. And if you happen to be a straight man, it actually makes no sense. It's an impossible emotional and spiritual orientation to think yourself into.
Wait, you'll have to explain this. What makes homoeroticism sort of this bedrock within Christian history?
Well, you know, in terms of Roman Catholicism now, the institution is controlled by males who are celibate, so who are not married to women. Many of them are living in all-male or same-sex communities, and they're promoting the love and worship of a kind of alpha male in the sky, i.e. God or Jesus. So they're not worshiping a woman. They're not eating the body and drinking the blood of a woman. They're eating the body and drinking the blood of a divine male. And so that privileges or selects for men who have what today we would call gay genders or gay spiritualities.
What does that say about the life of Jesus? How should we read that life? I mean, are you saying there's something homoerotic there?
Yes. I think there's a lot of scholarship on both Jesus and Paul, neither of whom were married. Jesus had a beloved disciple who was another man. Paul wanted all his followers, both male and female, to be virgins and to marry Christ, which is a very queer homoerotic notion for men. I think the origins of Christianity lie in this kind of sexual spiritual orientation that could not be fit in to the heterosexual structures of society.
Are you suggesting that Jesus was gay?
So I think that's an anachronistic question. I think the safest thing to say is that he was anything but straight. He wasn't a heterosexual male married to a woman with 2.5 kids and a golden retriever living in the suburbs.
You do like throwing bombshells, don't you?
Well, but see, Steve, lots of people have said this. There's a whole body of scholarship on this. I'm just speaking about it because it helps explain my own experience in the seminary and my own experience with Christianity.
So you said that the seminary was not the right place for you, went off to graduate school, ended up studying Asian mystical traditions. Why was that so appealing to you?
Well, because I became convinced that there were no heterosexual mystical models in Catholicism or Christianity. Hinduism fascinated me because there were all of these female deities with whom human males erotically unite or spiritually unite. That's really what drew me to it.
Hmm. And you've written about a profound transformative experience you had in Calcutta in 1989. When you say that you became Shiva, can you describe that experience?
Well, you have to know something about the iconography. So what I was actually studying was a tradition called Shakta Tantra. The iconography is a black or blue erotic goddess standing on her husband, Shiva, who is lying prostrate and is imagined as asleep or as in meditation or as dead. And she's often described as erotically engaging him. And during Kali Puja, which was this festival dedicated to this particular goddess, I had just been around the city visiting all the temples and kind of was embedded in this ritual display. And I went to bed and I woke up early in the morning and I couldn't move. I was paralyzed. I was lying on my back exactly like Shiva in the iconography. And this astonishing energy, erotic energy, entered the room or came out of me or came out of something and started to engage my body. And I was entirely conscious. I was perfectly awake, but again, I was paralyzed. My first assumption was that there was an electrical dysfunction in the wall and that I was being electrocuted. That's how strong it was. And then I thought I was having a heart attack and I was dying. And when both of those didn't happen, I sort of surrendered to it and it sort of imploded into my chest region. And at that point, I had the sensation of leaving my body and floating up to the ceiling in a kind of classic out-of-body experience or near-death experience. And when I eventually got back into my body and could move my fingers and my feet again, I felt as if this tremendous download had been transmitted into my body and my mind. And I couldn't have told you what it was about. I had no idea. I just had this sense that something profound had happened.
You've had a lot of years to think about this. And have you figured out what happened? I mean, can you explain this?
No, I can't. So early on in the 90s, I thought my job was to get to some interpretation of this event. Like there was some correct interpretation. But since then, I've abandoned that. I don't believe that, actually. I think the event was infinitely meaningful and that every book I've written so far has been an attempt to express it and that that was the point of the experience.
But clearly you don't think this was just, you know, you had an overactive imagination. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that you encountered some kind of transcendent dimension of reality.
Or of myself. I mean, I was electrocuted by some presence, and that electrocution was intelligent and had information in it. And I've spent the rest of my life trying to express that. I totally believe that, Steve. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm not believing anything. I'm not a fan of belief, actually. I think belief shuts us down and gives us easy answers. I'm simply describing what happened and how I've spent my life trying to make sense of it.
Jeff Kripal is a historian of religion at Rice University. He was talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Secret Body. They actually talked about a lot more than we have time for here, but you can read the rest of it in the LA Review of Books. The link is on our website at ttbook.org.